Hi, Radicals, and thanks for tuning in. This is Sam here from the Radical Writing Podcast. Some of these texts stretch content as experimentally as they do form, and this is a heads up that some episodes feature discussions of a particularly sensitive nature. For example, we may be reading and then elaborating on extracts which feature swearing, violence, and sexual content. And discussions will be compassionate and empathetic, but also, in order to accurately reflect the text, explicit. Engaging with these challenging topics is often key to the author's technique and central to the story they're telling, but they can be difficult subjects to discuss and listen to. Listen for the trigger warnings at the start of the episode, and if you prefer to avoid that episode, do check out another one from the series. And if you think that the series as a whole may not be suitable for you, that's okay too. If you are comfortable listening on, now is the time to pop your headphones on or to find a private space. Hello, Radicals, and welcome to the weird and wonderful literary world of the Radical Writing Podcast, the series dedicated to the best in contemporary, experimental, or innovative writing. This is episode 5, Russell Hoban's Ridley Walker. My name is Sam Kemp, and I'll be your host, I'm a poet and lecturer in creative writing. Today, my guests are Rebecca Newby and Jessica Pereira, and we've all chosen a favourite section of the text and prepared some questions for the group. There are some trigger warnings associated with Russell Hoban's Ridley Walker, and they include sexual violence, violence, and swearing. Ridley Walker is a novel set in a post-apocalyptic Southeast England. It's written in a dystopian dialect and explores the customs, rituals, and beliefs that have developed since a nuclear war, many of which are based on the interpretations and misinterpretations of the ruins and rumours of our own advanced civilization. In particular, a description of the 15th century wall painting, The Legend of St. Eustace in Canterbury Cathedral. The story follows a 12-year-old Ridley Walker as he inadvertently interferes with the politics and prophecies of the Iron Age government and religion. In this world, knowledge is spread in song, parable, and semi-supernatural performances, most notably in the Travelling User Show, a puppet show performed by the Pry Mincer and Shadow Mincer, Goodparley and Orphing. The show disseminates the story of the time back, way back, when civilization had calculated how to harness the power of nature for good and evil, culminating in the dropping of the One Big One, a nuclear bomb over Canterbury. After Ridley Walker finds a millennia-old figure of punch buried in the mud, he embarks on a journey which leads him to the ruins of Canterbury, and Folkestone. And Goodparley's ill-fated efforts to restart the quest for the master changes, advanced technology, science, and explosives. More than anything, it's a novel about defamiliarization, scripture, and puppets. It was first published in 1980 and was reprinted as a Penguin Modern Classic in 2021. And that edition includes some brief notes and afterward and glossary of the language that is spoken, Ridley speak. Okay, I'll let my guests introduce themselves at this point. Jessica, take it away.
Hi, I'm Jess. I'm a recent graduate from Northeastern University. I studied English literature with creative writing, and currently I'm reading all the books that I didn't have time to read during my 3 years of university, so I'm having a great time.
Hi, everyone. My name is Rebecca Newby. I'm an assistant professor in English at Northeastern University, London. And I have an interest in radical writing, but I kind of come to Ridley Walker from the perspective, from a medieval perspective, and with an interest in Canterbury Cathedral and pilgrimage.
Wonderful. Yeah, Rebecca, Jess, thank you so, so much for coming on.
No worries.
When I first designed the series, yeah, this was one of the first books that came out to me. It's one that I've been familiar with for quite a few years, and I've only ever read it once or twice before this summer, though, where I kind of got obsessed with it and read it about 4 or 5 times.
Five times? I'm surprised you can still spell.
It was only, I'm not sure if I can. That's kind of the result of the text there. We'll blame the text. I think it was only kind of on that last one that things really started slotting into place for me as to exactly what this story is about.
Really? How interesting. That makes me feel so much better.
Oh, really? Okay.
I found this really tough to read, I'm not afraid to say.
I think it is tough.
It's so difficult.
I think part of the reason for that is that, I mean, we kind of often talk about this in creative writing, and that if you got a novel that is set in some other world, you have to then spend time explaining that other world and the rules of that other world. And so I think, and then that you've also got to fit a plot and character development and all those things around it. And this novel does that. It does it really, really well. But so much of the pleasure of it, I think,
is in figuring out things about that world. And you come across different remnants of what we'd recognize to be our 21st century civilization. And you kind of have these little moments of thinking, oh, I know what that is. I took the power ring to be pylons and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of bits of town and stuff. So, yeah, you get this kind of pleasure where you sort of figure out, it's just this false sense of superiority, maybe. You're kind of like, oh, yes, we are advanced civilization. Yeah, I know what that is. This character doesn't. You have no idea. And I quite enjoyed
that. What was your experience of reading it, Jess?
I did find it quite challenging. Because when I read it, I was on holiday and I thought it was going to be just a normal...
It's not your leisurely read.
And then I opened it and it's just not... It's just words, jumbled up words. And I was like, great, this is relaxing.
Yeah, no, this is exactly my experience as well.
But I got, I guess, 3/4 of the way in and then something, I was talking to Sam about this, something clicked. Yes. And I suddenly felt like, oh, I get this.
Yeah.
I am in the world. And I didn't have to like question anything. I was like, this is just how it is.
Yeah, yeah. You slowly become subsumed, don't you, into the Ridley speak.
Mm.
But I think that initial struggle is part of the point, no? Mm. That you, we are meant to be slowed down in our comprehension of things. And you know, reading and writing are things that have almost disappeared from, from this dystopia. Right. Yeah. So I suppose we are also struggling to understand, struggling to make connections, a bit like Ridley himself struggles to make the connections between things, because, of course, he becomes the connection man, is it?
Yes. Yeah, called,
after his father dies. And my understanding of the connection man, I don't know if this is right, is someone who tries to make sense of the world based on different signs and symbols, but also the puppet shows the Punch and Judy type shows that that depict the user, the St. Eustace story. Is that right? I'm not sure.
I think that's spot on. That's what I got from it. Yeah. And I like the fact that you've already sort of brought up this kind of sense of slowing down as well, because I don't want to jump ahead to one of my questions, but one of mine kind of revolves around that as well, is what can we learn from this book? But maybe before we get there, Jess, do you want to jump in with your favourite section?
Right. My favourite section is right at the beginning.
Mm.
And it's the story of the heart of the wood. It says, my roding's been so hungry, I've grown so very thin, I've got a little cook pot, but nothing to put in. And then I'll jump to page 4, another section. Seed of the little, seed of the wild, seed of the burning is the heart of the child. Out goes the candle, out goes the light, out goes my story, and so good night. So it basically tells the story of two parents eating the heart of their child. Mm. So they partake in cannibalization because they have nothing else and they're very hungry.
Mm.
And I thought that entry to the novel was quite dark. And as a person who gravitates towards quite dark subject matter, I thought the use of like folklore was a great way to like introduce the society and try and understand what the subconscious is and just get into the gritty details. So also that kept running through my head throughout the novel.
Heart of the wood.
Heart of the wood, yeah. So,
I mean, I also, this was actually a close second for my favourite bit.
Oh, right.
Which is cool, isn't it? I really like this bit as well because it's starting with a story within a story.
Yeah.
Which, I'm going to say it again, ding, ding, reminded me of the Canterbury Tales because I've mentioned this on all of the podcasts I've been on. Because that's all about stories within stories as a way of learning more about the human condition and about different experiences and so on. And especially this story felt very ritualistic to me.
Yeah.
Reminded, especially the child part, it reminded me of kind of rituals, myths, dark myths and legends. And you're right in what you say, it kind of really sets up the rest of the book quite well and introduces us to some of the kind of dark undercurrents of what's going on here, and origin stories.
Yes.
So there's something very Old Testament about opening. And Mr. Clever seems to me to be a sort of devil figure who's kind of corrupting this Adam and Eve, this couple, into doing something forbidden. So I also like this bit.
The thing you said about origin stories, is, I guess it's kind of true because now I just thought about it. There's that Greek myth, isn't it, where the way Zeus is born and his father devours him and then he's like born out of something. So I guess...
Yes, in that not my way, strong point, Greek mythology, but yes, that sounds familiar.
Like the origin stories of Zeus, they're quite dark, so...
Yeah, and the Old Testament is as well.
Yeah.
Just, as well. And, but you know, Christianity, it reminds me of the Prioress's Tale as well, where there's a sort of child martyr or children as relics or, I don't know, it felt very familiar, this opening, in a strange way, in a deep way, even though it's really dark, as you say.
Yeah.
What did you think, Sam?
Yeah, I thank you so much for choosing this section, Jess, because I think it does set us up for the rest of the book. It's a parable, right? It's this little kind of strong parable that tells us about life in this world and warns us.
Yeah, totally. Sorry, and just something you've made me think of, and something I thought when I was reading again and again, is that this whole book contains a microgenre of proverbs and parables and proverbial wisdom. And that's what's kind of passed around to around the community. Sorry.
It feels like there'd be popular little tattoos, some of these rhymes, that in our world, not in the original world. Because it seems that's
like
how...
someone with a Carpe Diem.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, the amount of T.S. Eliot tattoos I've seen.
Oh God.
I'm kind of envious of, but also it seems to be very much done now. Maybe Ridley Walker is the next one. I love that. Was one of the main reasons why I love this, is that in this new post-apocalyptic world, and we're set, I think at one stage it's kind of mentioned, thousands of years into the future past our current date. That knowledge is passed on via story, via rhyme, via parable, via warning. And like you say, in this kind of Old Testament style, because it has authority. The rhyme has authority. Like you read, Jess, seed of the little, seed of the wild, seed of the burning is heart of the child. It kind of feels like we're being told something very important, something kind of spiritual that has a lot of weight to it.
But, and this kind of brings me to one of my questions, actually, so I won't repeat it later. But it seems to me that the legend of St. Eustace, of the man who goes into the wood and sees Jesus on the cross between the antlers of a deer, and then loses his family, one of his sons to a lion, one to a wolf, and on it goes, has been mixed up with this... what seems to me to be some sort of nuclear disaster.
Yeah.
So I can, and it comes back to working out the kind of puzzle within the language here. Adam and Eve, also surely Atom.
Atom, yes, that comes up, right?
And you, sir, St. Eustace, and I was thinking, but why you, sir, and not Eustace? And then it sort of made me think, maybe USA.
Oh, right.
And their involvement with the nuclear project, let's say.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, and I'm surely he's thinking, you know, he clearly loves wordplay. He clearly is thinking about the way that words sound. And I mean, I've had to read some of these words a lot, you know, aloud quite a lot, just to get to what they even mean, because I'm sorry, but the glossary just isn't comprehensive enough. and I'm just wondering about this wordplay here and why and how and why all of those got mixed up. And there's stuff about splitting the little man in two, splitting the atom. You know, there's clearly there are some references here. Did you guys get that as well?
I did.
The splitting of the little shining man. And then this kind of idea that Good Parley, the Prime Minster, spelled P-R-Y, Mincer, which is just kind of
But
funny.
Also Mincer, sounded to me like minstrels, as medieval storytellers as
minstrel
well.
Minstrel shows.
Exactly.
I thought from a kind of language point of view, it's just so charming. On a first read, I was kind of thinking, well, why?
That's a very good word.
Why use this language? Like, why is this here? And then the more I kind of thought about it, well, it makes perfect sense. In a post-apocalyptic world, you would have a post-apocalyptic language. If civilization and the buildings and culture has been obliterated and we know it, language would be obliterated.
It's funny that you say charming, though. I don't know what you think, Jess. Did you find it charming as well?
A mess,
yeah, exactly. But exactly, so it's alienating first, and then it slowly becomes charming because we have his real internal monologue with all of these kind of deep emotions, and he's Ridley himself, I mean, is so sincere.
Yes.
In what he thinks and feels, and that's what we're getting, his kind of internal monologue, right? Yeah. And his internal life. And I've forgotten what I was going to say next.
I think that was a really nice way of introducing his voice, because it is sincere.
Oh yes, that's what I was going to say, because there's a clear parallel or comparison here to Clockwork Orange.
Yes, yes.
And what Burgess does in that with the newspeak. Have you read Clockwork Orange?
I've seen the film, not read the book.
It's worth looking at if you liked this. But there, it's quite a kind of nihilistic thing, and quite negative, I think, the way they use. You speak, but here, I don't find that here.
No, it's not
negative. There's something quite charming, as you say, about the Ridley speak. So it's quite, you know, you can't just, they're not a direct, they're not the same, even if you make that comparison.
Yeah. There's a sort of, I think like you were kind of suggesting, Jess, you kind of just let it wash over you after a while and pick up on the sounds of words and find reason in them, but also know that we're not meant to find reason in every single thing, or at least it doesn't matter if we don't, because it's not our world. This is a kind of future world. It's a fraudulent artifact from a future world. So yeah. I'm gonna jump in with one of my favorite sections now, which is on page 174. So this is...
So at the other end of the book.
The other end of the book. We're going towards the end. And this kind of happened quite a few times, and I'm kind of keen to get your take on this, because it's a book which is almost always trying to explain itself and to explain the world that we're in. And generally, that's something that you kind of question, I guess, in creative writing. But I think, like you say, Rebecca, it's all tied together. The origin story, the nuclear religion, it's all tied together. And so as we figure out what's happened in the past, we figure out as well what's going to happen in the future. So I guess it's a kind of, we're being explained the rules of this world, but we're being explained in a way that it does contribute to the plot as well, and further to the plot. So yeah. This is one of those sections. I'm just going to read a couple of paragraphs halfway down page 174. And this is kind of towards the end, and Ridley is kind of having these revelations. He's traveling around southeast England, and he's seeing more and more as to what we've lost, and he's having these thoughts. It came to me what it were we'd lost. It came to me what it were has made them people time back, way back, better than us. It were knowing how to put themselves with the power of the wood become stone. The wood in the stone, and the stone in the wood. The idea in the heart of everything. If you could even just put yourself right with one stone, that's what kept saying itself in my head. If you could even just only put yourself with one stone, you'd be moving with the giant dance of the what everything, the one big one, the master changes. Then you might have the rest of it or not. The boats in the air or whatever. Whatever you'd done would be right. Them as made Canterbury must have put themselves right. Only it didn't stay right, did it? Summers in between them stone trees and the power ring, they must have put themselves wrong. Now we didn't have the one nor the other. Them stone trees were standing in the dead town, only we'd lost the knowing of how to put ourselves with the power of the wood, the power in the stone. Plus we'd lost the knowing what had whooshed the power round the power ring. So the reason that I've chosen this one again, it seemed to have something of an eco message, an environmental message, or just a kind of holicism or science, maybe, that is coming from our connection with the world around us and from nature. In what way can we kind of harness it and use it? And that is what Ridley is kind of looking back to. He's having this revelation that the reason why there were cathedrals or big buildings, which we gather there's very, very little evidence of, but there is still evidence of, is because back then in the 21st century or the 20th century, people were able to put their cells with the power of the wood become stone. I kind of took that to be maybe just a kind of alignment of person and natural resource, harnessing of natural resource, which obviously led to eventually the nuclear bomb. But yeah, did you kind of get like an eco message from the novel at all?
Yeah, I did. But I sort of interpreted it as different.
Yeah, go on.
When Ridley talks, he's quite deep compared to the other characters. You're very, more concerned with other things. He's concerned with like the inner, the self. He thinks about things much more deeply, I guess. And he sort of sees things as reciprocal. Things come back to you. Yeah. Even when he, he kills the boar at the beginning.
Yes.
He says, it's your turn now, but my turn later. Yes,
yeah.
And then even at the start of the book, actually, there's the little excerpt about the Gospel of Thomas. It says, the lion will devour man, lion will become man. So it's like this reciprocal relationship between nature and man. It's everyone's going to have their turn. Death is a cycle, life is a cycle, that sort of thing. That's how I saw the eco message as.
Kind of succumbing to those cycles or accepting those cycles.
That's a lovely point.
Working those cycles.
Yeah, which is quite mature for
a 12-year-old.
And actually, that is kind of, that's...
But in this world, he becomes a man at 12. And that, I think, perhaps tells us something about the life expectancy of the people in this world and at what point they're expected to grow up and take on responsibility and so on.
And that seems to be the reason why he's something of a prophet as well, because he's able to walk out into the world and make friends with the dogs. And the dogs follow him, and there seems to be that the dogs know something. Animals know something. Nature knows something that people do not. Because this is a world where there are gangs of dogs roaming the countryside that are kind of murderous. And so that kind of feeds into the mystique that becomes Ridley Walker, and he's kind of questioning that himself, yeah. Rebecca, do you want to come in with your favourite section at this point?
Yes, okay. So my favourite, or one of the sections that I really enjoyed, I would say, is on from page 134 or around there. So this is when Good Parley, the Prime Minister, is sharing with Ridley his kind of secret copy of the Legend of St. Eustace, and it's written in 20th century language, so we can assume it's a sort of relic from the old times, or the bad times, before the bad times. And Ridley isn't sure what any of it means. He says, "I don't even know half these words. What's a legend?" So Good Parley sets out to explain some of this to him. And I'm not going to read the entire thing because it's quite long, but I'm going to read a smattering of excerpts from this page and the next. Good Parley said, "I can explain the most of it to you. Some parts is easier work it out, nor others there's bits of it we'll never know for certain just what they mean. What this writing is about some kind of picture or diagram, which we don't have that picture, all we have is the writing." He goes on a bit later. "Saint is short for sent, meaning this bloke Eustace, he didn't just turn up, he was sent. AD 120, that's the year count they use to have it gone from year one, right the way to bad time. AD means all done." And a bit further on, perhaps it's on the next page, actually, he then kind of quotes various bits. I'm trying to find the bit. Oh, yeah. He says, he quotes, St. Eustace is seen on his knees before his quarry. And Good Polly says, which a quarry is a kind of digging. Why is he on his knees? What brung him down? What knocked him off his feet? What come out of that digging? A stag. Well, that's our heart of the wood, innit? We know him well enough. What's he got between his antlers is a cross of radiant light, which is the same as radiating light or radiation, which may be you've heard of. I said, no, I never. So it's really worth reading that part at length because it really reveals something that we were discussing earlier, which is this kind of misunderstanding or the theme of misunderstanding or a lack of comprehension, failing to understand. And that kind of reflects back on the reader as well, I think. And also the sense of things that are irretrievable. I think you mentioned that earlier, Sam. I can't remember. Things that can never be recovered.
I don't think I did, but I like that.
Oh, right, okay. I just imagined that. But, you know, obviously that's humorous, but there's a kind of more serious message beneath the humour there.
I'm really glad you chose this, yeah, because I love this section and I've got quite a few kind of highlights on it as well.
Okay, nice, go on.
Partly, just, I'm going to go back to the word charming. There's just a charm here where we're being told about the world in this quite reverential way. But of course we know that it's wrong by our terms of what AD stands for and things like that.
And quarry doesn't mean, quarry, you know, digging in a quarry means the thing that he's chasing or hunting, in this case, a stag, right?
And it kind of draws into question, well, I guess what right and wrong is in terms of fact or fiction.
Yeah, and how storytelling shifts and changes in oral culture and the kind of arbitrariness.
Yeah, flippancy maybe?
Yeah.
Of how easily the legend of St. Eustace is just kind of taken in tiny fragments and created this whole incredible new belief system that is dominating the world of Ridley Walker.
And the superiority that you get from Good Parley in this moment is just fantastic.
Yes, really funny. Yes. And he's a lovely character as well.
Well, is he lovely?
Well, he's not. He's not
very
to begin
good
with.
At speaking like a true politician, right? Hence the name Good Parley.
Yes.
He's very good at kind of spinning a story, as we see here.
I like the idea that some things have changed and some things haven't. And I wonder if that Good Parley and Orphing and Prime Minister, there's a lot of kind of political satire that's kind of going on there.
Yeah, I think so, definitely.
Sorry, I'm kind of dominating the conversation, but I just... what you kind of brought up was, for me, one of the main points of the novel and one of the main points of the kind of use of parable and rhyme and story was just this constant search for meaning and search for something and search for sort of something to grip in the world. It's not necessarily an overtly religious meaning in this particular world, but it seems to be, for Good Parley, it becomes a meaning of technology, advancement, of getting back what was lost, and that's kind of his mission. But yeah, that kind of constant search, everything seems to be drenched with prophecy, with meaning, if only we can interpret it correctly. It's a kind of anxiety.
Yeah, it's interesting the things that have been passed down and what's not been, and what's been left out. The Archbishop of Canterbury bit.
The Archbishop of Canterbury,
That was interesting to me because it's they've remembered that title.
Yes.
There's so many other things that have been lost.
Yeah.
And the words that are remembered become kind of refrains. It's almost poetic that help to explain the world, but also leave us kind of confused about what anything means or if any meaning can ever be stable.
And make us laugh.
Yeah,
like they seem like a joke as well.
Yeah.
Jess, do you want to come in with one of your questions?
Oh, right. Sure. Well, my first question is just why the cover of the novel?
Oh, good this recent question. Edition we've all got.
Yes.
Have you looked at any of the other covers?
No, I haven't actually. Just this one.
It's worth looking.
They're different, aren't they?
Yeah, there's the one I saw a couple. One of them had the Punch, and the Punch and Judy puppet Punch show. And Judy. Yeah. Yeah. One which is obviously quite key to the storytelling element of this.
Actually, yeah. I did see one of the cult. It was like Punch on the ground, and there was a dystopian sort of setting behind.
Oh, that's interesting, because that's not the one that I've seen. I've seen it sort of being held upright, but I have also seen another one where you can see a kind of like dilapidated city behind.
On the ground.
Yes, I think I saw that one as well.
Interesting. So that totally frames the novel in a different way before you've got to the first page.
But this one, do you want to say what you kind of thought about this one? That we've got modern, the Penguin Modern Classics one.
It confused me the most. That's why I wanted to know what you guys thought.
turning the question, right back around.
I tried to, I guess, find out about the artist, and it's called The Metallization of a Dream by Eduardo Paolozzi.
From the 60s.
And just this was, I guess, a very pop-up, surrealist-inspired artwork. Mm-hmm. And why this?
Mm.
And I thought maybe the presence of, like, machinery and metal might have something to do with the character's efforts to try and recreate something from the past, and this is their effort, which is this jumbled mixture of knowledge that makes no sense to us, but to them, they're finding something, and this is what it looks like. That's how I saw it, but what do you guys think?
Sam?
I think I really love the fact that you brought this up.
Same.
I think the title of the piece, The Metallization of a Dream.
What does that even mean?
I mean, that's so Ridley Walker. The whole novel sort of feels like that.
Yeah.
I think for me, I like the fact that you've kind of brought up that line, thin line between mechanics, machinery, production, things that we consider to be doing a job or a function, and art, which of course we'd all like to say does the same thing. I think we all believe it does the same thing. But where is the line between them, this beauty in the machine and beauty in mechanics. And I'm kind of going to go back to Good Parley, who, you're right, doesn't start off as a very nice character at all, but then we do end up pitying him towards the end and his efforts to bring back the master changes, because there's a kind of beauty in that dream of this utopia, which...
Do you want to explain what master changes means for our listeners?
What do you think it means?
I think it means kind of higher knowledge of the world.
I think so.
Or deeper knowledge.
That's kind of all I got. Yeah, I think we could say it means the splitting of the atom and the kind of harnessing of nuclear power. But I think it's
used, I think, in a, it's something more human than that.
I saw it as a sort of spirit.
Yeah.
That you can't see, but it's there. God,
I suppose.
Essentially.
Yeah. God in amongst humans.
Which for me kind of goes back to the nature, goes back to the stone and the wood. Mm. And in what way is there something in there?
I honestly had not thought about this cover, apart from what is that, when I opened the package that Sam sent to me. So I'm just thinking out loud here, but I mean, this is obviously, well, not obviously, but it seems to me surrealism meets industrialization.
Mm.
Yes.
But my first impression is that we've got all these random parts of kind of human progress. We've got a clock, different bits of machinery, some writing actually, a chair, a wheel. But they're all in parts, as you say, they're sort of a jumbled mess of metal parts, but they're in a box or in a kind of in a room. And that suggests to me that it kind of makes me think of how the people in this world, in Ridley's worlds in England, are kind of boxed in. They're kind of limited by their lack of past knowledge, and they don't really understand how they've got all these different random parts, these fragments of the old world, but they don't know how things fit together.
Yeah.
And they can't make it work. Just yet.
Yeah.
Perhaps once they get outside of their limitations in this way.
And that's kind of beginning to happen towards the end of the novel, right? When they're discovering the Yellowstone.
The sulfur.
Sulfur. Is that what it is?
It's sulfur? I think so.
Yeah, it is sulfur.
Explosives? I'm pretty sure. Oh, yeah, okay. Gunpowder, right?
I took it to be like gunpowder, yeah.
Well, yellow definitely suggests sulfur.
I looked it up. It
was, oh, did you? Oh, yeah, nice. Sulfur.
Good job.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah.
We have some
more sulfur in the room. We need one person to do it, yeah.
Sometimes you need to.
I think with a novel like this, yeah.
Oh, definitely.
I'm going to jump in with one of my questions. We're coming to the end of our episode, actually.
Okay, so is this the final
Well,
question?
I think maybe we can get another one in. But I'm thinking, what objects of 2023 do you think would litter a post-apocalyptic world that future generations would pick up and create new rituals, new beliefs around? We've got some buildings and like there's some machinery and metal and iron that seems to be dug up here. What is it from our age, do you think, that would
I've got many thoughts. What about you, Jess?
That's a good question. I mean, there's also puppets in this, which is really unexpected.
Yes.
Let me see.
I mean, for me, it would be electronics and plastics. Mm. Disposable vapes.
That's a good one.
Smartphones.
Yes.
Which people don't know what to do with.
No, that's what I thought,
Anything like that, you can imagine someone creating. There'd be enough disposable vapes to create some sort of building out of them, I imagine.
Yeah. Or consider them little idols of gods or something like that. If you're digging in the soil and some of them have different brands and some of them have different shapes, I'm sure you can conjure some religious
I can totally
rituals
see that.
From that.
The batteries from electronics, the lithium batteries being used to power things that we can't conceive of yet.
Yeah. I was thinking something away from technology.
Nice, that's good. That's a good counterpoint.
Yeah. Because I just want to see, I mean, I won't be able to see, but I want to know, or maybe imagine what they would do something. It's not a technological advancement like puppets. So say, for example, like, I want to know what they think of a hairbrush. Something like that. Or something. Glasses.
Yeah, definitely.
Or makeup. Shoes. They would have shoes, wouldn't they? I don't know.
They'd have something. I like the idea of makeup, though, that shows a whole cultural and social endeavor there.
Yeah.
What does that mean to future generations? Yeah.
Like puppets, it's not necessary, but it is in this world, so maybe.
Yeah.
I wonder what our myths, you know, would be as well.
Right.
Twitter would become some sort of god, presumably.
Yeah, social media.
Testament. People will be talking about the gods of social media.
Yeah.
But Facebook, you know, came down from the clouds. And
maybe like something. Zuckerberg would be like this god.
But surely that would be, you know, the kind of internet archive would be the first thing to go in the event of a solar flare or something. So it would be interesting to see if, you know, hard copy language writing would survive, actually, would have greater longevity than what's online.
That's interesting.
Even if right now social media and the internet is more ubiquitous, more ever-present in our minds, maybe that actually wouldn't survive.
This kind of great ghost of knowledge, which is the internet and the digital.
Absolutely, it is a ghost.
Just be gone.
It's a phantom.
This kind of brings me in mind of Ray Bradbury's The End of Fahrenheit.
Oh, yeah.
451. Where they're trying to memorize, and they have memorized Virgil and kind of ancient texts.
That's what we'd go back to, which I would love.
Yeah. Rebecca, would you like to come in with a quick-ish question, if that's possible?
I think I kind of asked my question earlier about the atom and USA. But I do have one quick question, which is that, is there a kind of pilgrimage here, do you think, was one of my kind of recurrent questions. And if we kind of think of pilgrimage as connecting with yourself, connecting with others or the world around you, rather than, I'm thinking about modern pilgrimage rather than the kind of traditional Christian pilgrimage.
Yeah.
Is that what's happening here? Or is there something more alienating about the kind of pilgrimage that Ridley goes on Or does it just sort of reveal the arbitrariness of rituals and either for him or for us?
I suppose that's the risk of pilgrimage. Potentially it could go either way whilst you're on the journey.
Yeah, I don't know.
Does it count as a pilgrimage if you don't know that you are on one? If you... Because in my head, it's a pilgrimage if you say, I am going on a pilgrimage.
But he doesn't... Yes, but he, even if he doesn't know the word, he still sets out on a journey, doesn't he, to discover knowledge.
Yeah.
Mm. No?
Yeah,
I don't know. Sorry, that's quite a jumbled up question.
I think it is a
pilgrimage. It's only because I was thinking about pilgrimage just yesterday.
Yes, yeah, I think it is a pilgrimage. And like you say, he discovers a lot about himself and the world around you, and that's exactly kind of what a pilgrimage is. But I also, like you say, I think maybe he's questioning language and questioning things.
I just would have been surprised if Hoban wasn't thinking about that, because Canterbury,
yes,
a journey to Canterbury, is about pilgrimage, traditionally.
There's one sentence in here which is like hidden in the middle of the book, which I think feels like it could almost sum up the whole thing, which is something like Canterbury has this pull to it. Canterbury pulls you to it, no matter where you are in the country. And so that feels like it, that's pull of pilgrimage, yeah.
Definitely.
All right, lovely. Let's wrap up the session there. So the 2021 Penguin Modern Classic paperback edition of Ridley Walker is the one we've been reading, and it's easy to get online or through your local bookshop or library, and as Jess points out, have this lovely cover on it as well. It's also available as an ebook, and there are plenty of secondhand copies available as well. Somewhat strangely, the entirety of the book, including its images, map, notes, an afterword, and a glossary, is currently available for free online. I'd like to thank my guests, Rebecca and Jess. Thank you so, so much for coming on. Now, Rebecca, you're going to receive your radical writing flag in another episode. But Jess, I can now present you with your very own radical writing flag.
Thank you so much. Much
coveted icon of our podcast.
Yes, lovely waving.
You have been listening to the Radical Writing Podcast. A huge thank you to my guests, Rebecca Newby and Jessica Pereira. And an equally huge thank you to our production team, Alistair Robinson, Mark Dutton and Rob Adey. Join us next time for episode 6, where we'll be discussing Maggie Nelson's Bluets. And as always, stay radical.